Hi, my name is Benjamin Van Allen. I wrote episode 8, Familiar, of season 11 of The X-Files, and you're listening to The X-Cast.
Everyone, and welcome back to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. And when I say here, I actually mean a pub in Birmingham. I'm Tony Black, and I'm joined by Carl Sweeney.
Hello, Tony. Good to see you.
Yeah, and we literally can. That's the thing. We're actually face-to-face for the first time. And as you can tell by the beeping, yeah. we're not over Skype. We're actually, we're in a public house, and we've just been to see a film, haven't we?
We have, and what a good film it was, wasn't it?
It was a good film. Yes, it was the Leslie Nielsen remake of Mr. Magoo. No, we are joking. Where's that come from? Where have I got that one from?
You're a sick man, Tony. I am.
Clearly am, yeah. Now, we've been to see the great Sidney Lumet film, 12 Angry Men, haven't we?
We have. One of the best courtroom dramas, I suppose. Although you're not really in the courtroom a great deal.
No, because it's all about a jury, and they're doing all the deliberation afterwards, and it's great character drama from the 50s. I'd recommend anyone check out, really.
And second that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And seeing that on the big screen was a real thrill. And we've been planning to meet up for ages. We haven't quite got around to it. And we thought, we'll do a podcast sitting in a pub, which is why you'll be able to hear incidental sound. I think right now it's
Maroon 5.
They're busting out all the old early noughties classics here, aren't they? Yeah. If we're lucky, you'll get a bit of Top Loader like later. but yeah, we thought we'd go and see 12 Angry Men as a jumping off point for for a discussion about movies in relation to the X-Files. So because there are a lot of cinematic touchstones for the X-Files, aren't there?
There are, and it's also the case that you always hear Chris Carter saying, like, it's like we're making a movie every week, and there are very much trying to push the idea that the X-Files was a cinematic series, weren't they? So, this sounds like a good idea to me.
Yeah, because he put Dwayne Barry on, didn't he, on a cinema screen. And that's where he got I think that was the first point he realised the show could be cinematic. Mm. And then, after that, thoughts were thinking about the movie, and what became Fight the Future and things like this, even though it was a few years before it materialised. We were thinking about this, and we thought about, how come, because we're both big film fans, we often chat about films and things like that, and having just gone and seen a film, we thought, what can we do to tie the two together? And you'd suggested a while back an idea of doing a show about the X-Files in relation to cinema. So we put those two things together, and we've decided to come up with our top five movies that the X-Files has been inspired by in many ways, or has... where there is a connective bit of tissue. So it should be quite a fun discussion.
I think it will be, yeah. And there's loads to choose from, isn't there? There are just so many references, and these guys who wrote the series, clearly big film fans.
Yeah. So you can see it, can't you, really?
You definitely can, yeah.
I remember you put a post up, I think, it was in the basement group ages ago, about a lot of the niche sort of cinema. I think, was it from a Darren Morgan episode that you did this about?
I can't remember, because that was way back in the early days of the basement, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But there are tons, and we got some good stuff in that post. We might have to give it a bump, mightn't we?
I think we need to dig it out and find it, because I think you were talking about Hitchcock as well. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. I wonder what song we're going to get next. What do you reckon?
Angels by Robbie Williams.
Angels. Could be. We're on a bit of a late 90s, early noughties fest, so anything's possible. So, yeah, we'll probably just end up just going off tangent talking about songs. So if we do that, guys, I apologise. So let's do it. Let's talk about our top five. So do you want to kick off? And these aren't necessarily in any specific order of preference, but you kick us off.
First one that came to mind for me was the episode-long riff in Ice the season one episode Ice on John Carpenter's The Thing from 1982. Is this on your list as well?
No, it's not. And just to preface this, neither of us know what each other's going to be coming up with here. We've kept it secret to, you know, preserve the surprise.
Yeah.
But that I didn't put The Thing on because I knew you would.
Oh. Well, I had to because, I mean, first of all, I mean, I love Ice. I don't know if you do, but I think Ice, up to that point, it's like sixth episode of the series or something, isn't it? It's right.
Something like that, yeah.
I think it's the best episode up to that point, you know. And what I like about it is that it's not just a rehash, though, isn't it? It's clearly inspired by The Thing, but I think it becomes its own thing for two reasons.
Its own thing. Very good.
I just think it's so well executed. I think David Nutter directed that episode. I think he really pulls it off. But also, it's a great little character study for Mulder and Scully, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Gets under their skin, really, and, you know, putting them in that situation where they're faced with having to challenge each other's perception of, you know, are they really who they are? You know, we're not who we are.
Chills.
And that's obviously, you know, and you see The Thing has influenced so many things over the last, like, 30 years or more,
nearly
40 years, in terms of, you know, so many science fiction series do The Thing episode. I was watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. recently. Right. I was doing a massive, which isn't the most highbrow show in the world, but, you know, it's damn good, actually. I'm quite a champion of that. I think it's really fun. And they did one. They did The Thing, and I said to my fiancé, I said, The Thing episode. You get one in everything.
Well, it just lends itself to a TV episode, doesn't it? Because it's like, you know, it's a single location, basically.
Yeah.
A small group of characters. And, I mean, the thing about the film is it's just drenched in, like, paranoia and trust.
Yeah, really is.
And so it lends itself to kind of new iterations, I think. I mean, there was a remake. I mean, The Thing itself is a remake, isn't it?
Is it The Thing from Another World?
That's right. That was 1951.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah. And then Carpenter's The Thing... 82. And then there was a prequel to that which came out a few years ago, 2011. I don't know if you saw that.
I liked that, actually.
I didn't think it was quite as bad as everyone else seemed to. Yeah.
No, I mean, it was almost like fan fiction in a way, in that it was just tying things together. But I loved the ending. The ending directly leads into The Thing with the same music, you know, the dum-dum, dum-dum stuff. And I thought it was just really... It was all right. I mean, it's not nearly as good as the 82 thing. I mean, not much is, but it was fine.
And I've just got this memory, like, etched into my brain of when I saw The Thing. I think I was staying up late. I wanted to stay up late to watch a Formula One race. So I think it was the Australian Grand Prix, 2 a.m. it started our time.
Yeah.
And I was just looking for something to watch, and I happened upon The Thing. I think I'd missed some of it. And anyone who's seen the film will know there's this, like, chest defibrillator scene, which kind of takes a turn.
Yeah.
You know, and I must have been about 13 years old, something like that.
Mm.
It was still the age where I would get scared of stuff, because it doesn't really happen anymore.
Mm.
But I was just kind of in the grip of this story, you know.
It's one of those that has made a mark on you.
I guess it has. I guess it has, you know. In terms of The X-Files, though, what I like about it is that... this is still early season one, isn't it?
So yes, yeah.
Kind of. This
still fairly new.
The series is still kind of going under the radar. It's still very much a cult series, you know. And I think what Morgan and Wong did there is that their homage to The Thing is not as self-conscious as some of the later episodes where it's a huge series and they say, oh, you know, we'll do, I don't know. Like, I love Monday, but, you know, everyone associates it immediately with Groundhog
Day. Yeah.
You know. And, like, there's no getting away from the fact that they're riffing on The Thing.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, who can blame them? It really worked out well, didn't it, for the
series? It did. And it is one of those more direct sort of, you know, homage. Not rip-off as such, but definite homage, you know, compared to some of the other TV shows that do a Thing episode. They're not the exact same. You know, this literally has Mulder and Scully in the Arctic in a base with, you know, alien worm thingies. So it's, you know... But it's a great episode, and it's a great film. Is that your favourite John Carpenter?
I don't know, because I love Halloween, truly. I do love Halloween. I really like The Fog, actually.
The Fog's good,
I don't know if people generally hold that one in the same esteem. But I really like Carpenter. I did a lot of stuff. Assault on Precinct 13, I really enjoy.
He's great.
He had a really good hot streak, I think.
He did. I'll give you mine. Big Trouble in Little China.
That's your favourite?
Love that.
Yeah.
He's probably done better films, but that's my favourite.
And is that because you saw it at an impressionable age?
Absolutely. Not that that's a biased reason at all. But no, it's a good one to kick us off with, The Thing.
Cool.
So, I'll
Yeah.
I'll take us to the next one. I've gone for,
right,
in connection to Paperclip, although this can connect to various different episodes, specifically Eve as well, I've gone for The Boys from Brazil.
Interesting.
Which is a 1975 film by a director called Ira Levin, I think, if I've got that right, or he wrote the book. It's based on a book which is about a hunt for Dr. Joseph Mengele, ultimately, who's in the film played by Gregory Peck.
Yeah.
In a really, actually 1978, not 1975. I get that wrong. And Ira Levin wrote the book. You can tell I'm looking at IMDb now.
Levin's the guy who wrote Rosemary's Baby. Is that
yes,
right?
That's right. Yeah. And it was Franklin J. Schaffner who directed the film. Not massively familiar with his work, but it's basically Mengele, Gregory Peck as Mengele trying to reconstitute the Reich from his secret base in Paraguay, while the Nazi hunters from Steve Guttenberg randomly
right?
in an early role, pre-Police Academy role, as a Nazi hunter who's trying to track him down. It's got a brilliant cast though. Laurence Olivier, he's an old Jewish guy who is part of the hunt. James Mason.
That's a pretty good impression.
Thank you very much, Carl. I can do him better than Olivier. He went off the boil then, nice, but anyway, nice. For a while it was fine. Denham Elliott, lots of really famous, including Walter Gatell, who was in Paperclip as Dr. Victor Klemper.
Yeah. I have to confess, I haven't seen The Boys from Brazil, shockingly. So,
gasp. No, do you know what though? It's not one of those films that's like massively well known in a way. It's like I think it's one of those that kind of, because I mean it's not a big blockbuster in the sense of like the late 70s blockbusters were. It's not like Jaws. It's not like Star Wars. It's not like Alien. It's a drama. It's got science fictional elements because ultimately I think Mengele is trying to create clones, like Nazi clone children, basically. So there's a certain science fictional element, but it's quite slowly paced.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite measured. I'd be lying if I said it's perfectly well directed, because it does have a bit of that late 70s sort of drag that some dramas do have. But it is wrapped up in that. It's one of those films that the way it's made could only be 70s.
Yeah.
Because it has that paranoia conspiracy element.
So are there specific scenes that you feel have been like lifted into The X-Files, or is it story elements or what?
I feel like it's more the story elements. I mean, I think Paperclip, it was the whole idea of, Nazi war criminals being brought into the United States to work on things. In this case, it's the whole idea that, Klemper was in The X-Files essentially Mengele, wasn't he? The Nazi angel of death. He's a similar kind of guy who's brought over, and he's trying to, if not atone for his sins, then, helping to cover them up.
Mm-hmm.
So he struck a chord in reminding me of that. And then, like I say, Eve. Even though Eve, the episode isn't about Nazis, it has a certain Aryan level to it, with the twins. What are they called?
Cindy Reardon.
Cindy and something. Yeah, I can't remember the other one. But yeah, and obviously Harriet Harris as Sally Kendrick, the Doctor, who is it's, I mean, really great early episode. But that kind of science is the link, really, and the whole idea that The Boys from Brazil is about sort of fringe science. It's not fantastical in the sense there's no magic in it. There's no.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the. It's one of those films I wouldn't be surprised if Chris Carter had watched when he was younger,
definitely.
Because even though it's not a direct inspiration as such, I think there's DNA in there that is very X-Files. There is this level of conspiracy, there is this level of cover-up, there is this level of, great sins being, exposed by a very cynical 70s.
Mm.
So you'd love it, I think.
Well,
you really
I'm
going
to go home, I'm going to fire up Netflix, I don't know if it's on there.
I don't know.
Probably not.
Well, I've got, since we're here, I've got this great app, and I recommend this to anyone, called Just Watch.
Okay.
Are you familiar with this?
No, I'm not. No.
This is really good, right? It shows you, I'm showing you now, it's you type in, it shows you what's just come out on whatever streaming services you want to tailor it to. So I'm going to type in The Boys from Brazil, and if it's a relatively well-known film, you click on it, it will tell you where you can get it.
So I need to buy it on Amazon.
So the only way, it's not on any streaming in the UK. Okay. Then if you're in America or you're wherever you are, it will be a different service.
Yeah.
But you've got, you can only buy it on Amazon. If I was you, I'd just get on Amazon and buy it cheap on DVD.
Sold.
It's well worth it. So yeah, I really like that one. I'd recommend anyone who likes the Nazi episodes or the fringe sort of clone science episodes of the X-Files to check that one out, because I think they'll dig it.
Cool. So should we go on to my number
four?
Well, this one is just the scene really from an episode. Okay, so I've chosen the mirror sequence, the funfair sequence in Humbug.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Because I'd always assumed Darren Morgan, I mean, this is the scene at the end of the episode where Leonard leads the agents in and you sort of see Scully in front of the mirrors and everything.
Mm.
I'd always assumed Darren Morgan had pinched this from Orson Welles. He made a film called The Lady from Shanghai, which is a great little film.
Okay.
Him starring himself and Rita Hayworth. And that's got a famous ending in a funhouse.
Right.
Or in front of a hall of mirrors, anyway. And I'd always assumed that was the impetus for this in Humbug. But then I saw an interview with Darren Morgan where he said, no, that's not the case. And he seemed to say he was thinking more about a Charlie Chaplin film called The Circus.
Okay.
All right. So, I mean, I love Chaplin, and The Circus is one of his funniest films. You know, he's the little tramp, obviously.
Mm.
He's mistaken for a pickpocket, he escapes into the circus, and he accidentally kind of crashes the show and becomes a hit. But he can only be funny when he's not trying to be funny. It's kind of the setup anyway.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, it's a great film, lots of funny moments. There's some great stuff in there, like, you know, stuff involving a tightrope, where, because obviously they could fake stuff in those days, but not in the same way that they can today, you know. So, you know, a lot of stuff is done in camera.
Yeah.
You know, so I really like those silent comedians, because they really do some, like, elaborate, like, stunt work and stuff. I love slapstick comedy, you know.
Mm.
And so I chose it really because I like silent comedy so much. I mean, the cinema we've just been to, The Electric in Birmingham, I mean, they from time to time show silent films. I've been at screenings there where I'm like the youngest person in the room by like half a century.
Well, you got, don't haven't you gone and watched like Buster Keaton?
Love Buster
there.
Keaton.
Yeah.
I mean, Keaton and Chaplin are my two main ones. I think Keaton's the better filmmaker, but Chaplin's naturally funnier, so they kind of cancel themselves out.
Yeah.
So I love them both, you know. So yeah, I mean, what about you? Do you delve much into the silent era? Or is that
I confess, really? No, not yet. It feels like something that I will get to. What I want to do, possibly as part of my writing and my blogging and whatever, I want to start doing pieces on the history of cinema. You know, I've been going on YouTube and looking at some of the really early like 1880s like short film stuff, the early days before you even got like things like Méliès, you know, coming up with all this stuff.
The train arriving at the station.
The one that scared people to death. So I feel like there's a big education with silent cinema. And, you know, I don't think I've ever properly sat through a Charlie Chaplin or a Buster Keaton film, I'll be honest, all through my life. So, there's a lot to come for me.
Yeah, well, there are certain touchstones I think could be well worth checking out. I think, like, the silent era, when it was coming to its end, like the mid-20s to the late 20s, the films were really, like, fluid and they really always sang, you know. And then it's kind of a shame that the coming of sound happens, really, because if we'd had another decade of silent films, it would just so much more great stuff would have been made. But Charlie Chaplin's got another place in X-Files history, of course. I don't know if you know about this story. You know what I'm going to say?
Oh, do you know what? No, but I feel like I should, and I feel like I've heard something before.
Well, this is the story anyway. I'm kind of paraphrasing because I can't remember, but it's the episode Home. And there's a passage, apparently, in Chaplin's autobiography where he talks about he ends up in this house. I'm not really sure what the particulars are. He ends up in a house where a mother gets wheeled out from under the bed.
Right.
And supposedly that, many years later, becomes kind of the germ of an idea that becomes Mrs. Peacock in Home.
Oh, right, you know? Okay.
So,
that's interesting.
Obviously, Home's one of my favourite episodes.
Yeah,
so that's,
same.
I mean, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
So,
cool.
So I thought I'd sneak that one in under the radar by picking the Humbug mirror sequence from my number four.
So there's a similar mirror sequence in that film.
Yeah, so Chaplin ends up in front of the fun house. I think it's when he's being chased by the cops, I think.
Yeah.
And apparently Darren Morgan was thinking about this when he was writing Humbug.
Mm.
Despite the fact that there are some other sequences in films, you know, like I said, Lady from Shanghai, I think Manhattan Murder Mystery ends up with a Hall of Mirrors sequence as well.
Mm.
You know, I mean, you never know with these interviews with people like Darren Morgan whether they're kind of misdirecting you away from what their real influences are. But I'd like to think it's Charlie Chaplin.
It could be. It would make a lot of sense, I think. And there's, you know, it could be part of the mix of what he was thinking of, I suppose. So, yeah, I'll go with my number four now. And I've gone for one, again, based on a scene.
Yes.
Particularly from, from Ascension in season two. And I'm going for the cable car scene. Do you know where I'm going with this? Have you figured out where I'm going with this?
Are we in the, you know, the sexy 70s again?
We might well be. The very end of the tail end of the sexy 70s. Because when talking about the X-Files, it's been stated that the cable car sequence with Mulder heading up to Skylar Mountain to some extent was inspired by Moonraker. The 1979 James Bond movie starring Roger Moore.
Yeah.
Which I'm particularly fond of, actually. It does not get a good rep, does Moonraker.
Do you think that's because it has, like, a pigeon doing, like, a triple take at one point?
And the gondola, like, on wheels driving through Venice. Probably. It is, you know, Bond at its super silliest. Mm. And it came off the back of Star Wars, in that Star Wars came out in 77 after The Spy Who Loved Me, and they went, let's not do a gritty sort of, you know, what became For Your Eyes Only, a gritty sort of down-to-earth Roger Moore. Let's put him in space! Which is what they did for the hilarious, like, final half an hour. Don't get me wrong, I'm well aware it is not Premier League Bond, but I enjoy the fact that Roger Moore is just... It's like having a bath for him now. You know, he's at that point, he's just so comfortable in the role. It's the classic sort of Bond thing I grew up with. All the gadgets, all the girls, the silliness, the really great villain, Drax, who is great in the sense he comes out with some of the best urbane one-liners. Like, you Mr. Bond, you return with the unpleasantness of an unloved season, or something like that. It's like, the tedious inevitability of an unloved season. Genius. Genius
line. But is it as genius as the double entendre? Or is it? It's kind of a single entendre that ends Moonraker from Q.
Oh, is it? Which one is it? Is it? It's not the Keeping the British End up one,
no,
is it?
No, it's not that one. It's.
I just remembered it. Yeah, go on, go on.
I think he's detecting reaction.
This is brilliant. It's brilliant. And of course, Moonraker has a cable car sequence in which Bond is plunging down towards Rio. And he's being chased by Jaws, the big hulking, you know, the most iconic henchman in James Bond history.
Yeah.
Big tall guy with metal teeth.
Okay. Yeah.
And this is the film that gives him a love interest and makes him a good guy at the end as well, which is just hilarious. This little Swedish girl with pigtails.
Yeah.
It's lunacy. It does have one of the best Bond scores, though, by John Barry. Gorgeous, gorgeous score.
And it's got a really good opening sequence. I really like that. It's where it's like a skydiving set piece, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's really good stuff.
It's a shame it ends with Jaws plunging into a circus tent, but, you know...
I mean, you can't
have it all. No. But it's a tenuous link, but the whole idea of the cable car is one of the most iconic things from Moonraker, so...
Yeah, you know. No, I think it's a good one. I really like that sequence in Ascension, too. I think Duchovny did as much stunt work as possible, supposedly, didn't he, as well? But there's another X-Files link, I think. It's a season 11 Moonraker link.
Oh!
You know Mr. Y's plan? What was it? It was to, like, kind of get everybody off the planet.
Yeah! Space colonisation.
That's kind of like Drax's plan, isn't it?
That's true.
He wants to get everybody off the planet. He wants the most beautiful people off the planet, doesn't he?
And he also wants to destroy everyone with a killer virus.
Well, that's like the Smoking Man's plan.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Season 11 is like double Moonraker.
Season 11 is double Moonraker.
Yeah.
I'd never thought of that before. That's perfect. Wow. There's a theory. There needs to be a piece written about how season 11 is basically Moonraker.
I just like the idea Carter was kind of stuck for ideas. You know, he's kind of flicking channels and sees Roger Moore and, you know.
I know what I can do. I found it. I suppose as well, you know, the sequence in Ascension, which it was the first real know, we talked about cinematic influences, but Dwayne Barry, you know, and things like that, and that first visual sort of cinematic idea. But Ascension's the first action Mulder sequence, really, isn't
yeah.
it? You know, and obviously they carry that then through to things like Nisei and 731 and Tunguska, where he's you know,
escaping gulags.
Gulags.
Outrunning horses.
Trains. And... all this stuff, yeah. You know, the action Mulder stuff. But it's the first instance of that, really.
But there's like still a vulnerability to him, which perhaps isn't present in season 11 when he's kind of taken out Mr. Wise goons like by the dozen.
True. Like, he's gone from being sort of a half-hearted Bond into, you know, Charles Bronson by that point, hasn't he? Yes. But in my struggle, four, he's just like a lethal killing machine. Or yeah, but yeah, it's a tenuous link. But I'm a huge Bond fan, and yeah. I even though it's not by any means my favourite Bond film or the best Bond film. I have a soft spot for Moonraker, especially now it's basically season 11.
Perfect.
Even
well,
more.
To be honest, I thought about putting that on my list as well, so yeah, that's a good choice.
Okay, cheers. What's your number three then?
Yeah, I didn't put it on my list. My number three.
No, you put actually proper films.
Yeah. Well, no, Moonraker, I'll stand by Moonraker any day.
Yeah.
This is a film that inspired, I think, two episodes, okay? So the two episodes I believe it inspired are Our Town from season 2. And Roadrunners from season 8, and it's a film from 1955 called Bad Day at Black Rock.
Ah,
okay.
Now, before you carry on,
yeah,
with me, Paige Schechter and I are planning to do an episode on this. So this is going to be a good entry point into talking about Our Town and Bad Day at Black Rock specifically. So this will be a nice little hors d'oeuvre, primer for that. Yeah.
Well, I think I've seen the writers of these two episodes cite Bad Day at Black Rock in various interviews. I mean, I think both of those are good episodes. I legitimately think Roadrunners is like a classic X-Files.
Brilliant.
What about you?
Sarah's wrong.
I can hear Sarah almost hear her laughing at us right now.
She's wrong. You're wrong, Blair. Sorry.
I really
Skinner's
do.
Dead.
One of the last classic X-Files episodes, I think. And what links them is that they're both kind of small town with a secret episodes.
Mm.
And that's very much the kind of story that Bad Day at Black Rock is.
Yeah. Though.
So I guess you'd describe it as kind of a post-Western. It's not really a Western in the sense that it's set after World War II, I think, so it's kind of after the historical era that you sort of think of as the Wild West.
Yeah.
And it's kind of got this hard-boiled quality, so I guess you could kind of chalk it up as a film noir in some senses too.
Mm.
It's about... It stars Spencer Tracy. He's a guy. He's a one-armed man. He's looking for a guy in a... It's not even a town, it's kind of a hamlet, really, called
okay.
Black Rock.
Yeah.
Looking for a guy called Tomoko. And he uncovers this, like, terrible secret within the community, you know. So what it turns out to be is a really tense film, a really strong message about like racial prejudice going through it, you know. And what I think is appropriate to the X-Files is the film kind of depicts a small community that kind of closes ranks, you know, around one of its members, around a secret.
Yeah.
And how many X-Files towns can we think of, you know, that's kind of what's going on.
Familiar, know? Most recently.
Most recently, yeah.
You could say absolutely. That about...
And, you know, this film has a great cast. You know, Tracy's brilliant in the lead role, but people like Robert Ryan, Lee Marvin, Walter Brennan, you know.
Yeah.
So essentially, I chose it because I love Roadrunners, and it's kind of a touchstone for that. I really do like Westerns as it happens, and it's kind of a post-Western. You can kind of slot it into that genre, you know. So those are the reasons why I chose that. And Our Town's pretty good, too. I do like that one. So it inspired Our Town, but I think Roadrunners is the better episode.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Our Town's all right. Yeah, I've got nothing against that. That's interesting because I haven't seen Bad Day at Black Rock yet. I'm looking forward to getting into it. So no, it's nice that there are some of these touchstones going back into, you know, some classic cinema, really. You know, and you know, it's not just Bond films and and films about Nazis.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to push the point too much. I mean, there was no Jesus slug.
No.
Bad Day at Black Rock.
Sadly. Yeah. There we go. See, it is. Jesus slugs would make almost everything better.
They really would.
I think.
Really would.
But no, it's a good one. Good number three.
Thank you. And yours?
Mine is going off the episode Avatar in season 3. Now, I'm going off a specific visual piece of iconography here. Can you guess where I'm going to go with this?
I think so. I think it's the red coat.
Well, it is the red coat on the succubus, I think it is. Now, what film specifically stands out from your knowledge
well,
with a red coat?
This is also on my list, as it happens.
Oh.
So I believe we're thinking about Nicholas Roeg's film, Don't Look Now.
Don't
is that correct?
Look Now, yeah. I think, again, it's 70s. What is it with me in the 70s?
Yeah,
like, it might, but to be honest, I think it is my favourite film decade, the 1970s. It is 1973, yeah, good guess. based on a story by Daphne du Maurier, the classic novelist.
The Birds.
Rebecca, who Hitchcock, you know, did a lot with. Nick Rogue is one of the great British film directors. He's not, I don't think, out of film fan circles, I don't think his name is massively well known in the way that someone like Hitchcock is.
No.
Which is a shame, because he's made some of the most fascinating and strange movies ever. And this, Don't Look Now, is all about a couple played by Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie, who, after the death of their infant daughter, they go to Venice in order to try and, you know, move past it in many ways. And they get embroiled in this really creeping sort of tale involving started with these two elderly sort of psychic sisters. Yeah. And I don't really want to say too much more about it, because it's all about grief, but it gets really odd. And there is a character in it with a red coat, and it builds to one of the most terrifying moments I think cinema has ever given us.
It does, and this actually, in a way, this is kind of the film that kind of kickstarted my love of films in a funny sort of way. I think I must have been about 13 when I saw it, and I think I maybe was just trying to develop an interest in films, or maybe this started, I'm not sure, I can't quite remember, but it's such a haunting, seductive, like you say, elegant exploration of love and grief, isn't it?
Mm.
But what really inspired me to check it out was I saw the TV listings, right, and the write-up for Don't Look Now said the film with the famous sex scene between Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie. So I was like, no, this is just how pathetic I am. I was like, right, drop everything.
Go watch that.
Guess, I don't know, probably a weeknight, probably a school night or something. It was like 10:45 it would have started. And I think the sex scene is about, I mean, it's a great scene, isn't it? Because do you remember the way it's done? It's kind of cut between them getting dressed afterwards and the act
and
itself.
The act itself.
And there's some really nice music playing over it.
And the rumour is that the long-standing cinematic myth is that they actually did have sex.
Yeah.
And there's ambiguity over whether that's true, but it sure looks like they might have done, actually. It's always that intense.
It is intense. I've always assumed that wasn't true.
It might just be apocryphal.
Yeah.
But...
So, I mean, that comes about half an hour into the film, I think. So I was planning, basically, to watch up to that point and turn off. But as it happened, I was just sucked into this story, you know, and so atmospheric, very sophisticated the way it's done, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and I probably watch that film every 2 or 3 years, you know, and it's never lost its power. Like you said, the final sequence.
Oh, we don't want to ruin it for you.
And like the location work in Venice and everything.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the tether to Avatar, and whether it was intentional or not, one suspects it might have been.
Yeah.
Given the fact that the succubus has a red coat, but the other thing is the fact that it's about partly about a broken marriage. Avatar.
Yeah.
You know, and the Skinner and Sharon and his wife Sharon, and you know it's tied up with Skinner's, you know, off duty kind of relationship. Situation, and you know, it, you know, Don't Look Now, he's very much about a marriage that's trying to survive, you know, a trauma and a death.
Yeah.
And even though it's not a complete exact parallel with Avatar, there are thematic connections.
And also, what you have is the switch with the figure in the red coat from a, you know, a not an innocent figure, but from a benign figure, to a grotesque figure,
something terrifying. Yeah,
that's what you get. Like I say, we don't want to spoil.
We don't want to spoil it.
But that very much becomes a factor in.
But if you haven't seen it, guys, go off, watch Don't Look Now, and then come back and tell us what you thought at the end. Because if you weren't terrified, I'd be surprised. All right. So yeah, I'm glad we both had that one, because that one immediately leapt out at me as a big thing, really. And it is a masterpiece. It's one of the best films ever made.
I think it really is.
It's one of my favourite movies.
It's always one I list in my like top tens and you know, that kind of thing.
It's amazing. It's an amazing film. Truly. So was that my number three? That was my number three.
It's on my list at number five. So I've got.
Have you got two more now or one more?
One more, I think.
You've got one more. Okay. But you have a least favourite. I couldn't think of one. Alright, I forgot. So we'll just do your least favourite at the end.
Okay.
Yep. Right? And then we'll just it kind of brings up to five each.
Okay.
Doesn't it? So unless we've got the same one again, which we might have done.
I think we might do. So you want mine now?
Go on then, you go for your last one.
I'd be amazed if this isn't on your list. It's the Russian roulette sequence from an episode you may have seen once or twice called Pusher.
I've heard of Pusher, yeah. It's not.
It's not on your list.
No, it's not. And I know. And I was tempted, but I thought it's too obvious. Everyone knows Push is my favourite episode. I'm going down too obvious a route. Right. So
happy to help you out there.
Yeah.
So what film am I thinking this is taken from then?
Could it be The Deer Hunter?
It certainly is.
Yes.
Yeah, it certainly is. So The Deer Hunter, 1978, directed by Michael Cimino.
70s again.
It is, isn't it?
We're obsessed.
What does that say about us? I don't know. Have you seen the film?
Once, a long time ago. I need to go back to it.
I think it's a very powerful film. I think whatever criticisms you can level at it, and I think people do, you know, things about its racial politics and stuff. People have issues with its representation of the Vietnamese and so on.
Yeah.
Well, whatever you can say about it, it's just a very... It's got this kind of elemental power that I just find gripping, you know. It's about a group of small-town steel workers. I think they're from Pennsylvania, you know. The cast includes Robert De Niro, Christopher Walken, John Cazale, a young Meryl Streep, one of her first films. I think it might even be her first film. What's that?
Could be.
Right at the outset of her career, anyway. You know, and the guys get sent off to fight in the Vietnam War, or they go off to fight, you know, and get captured and forced to play Russian roulette by their captors, you know. And that's probably what the film's most famous for, is those Russian roulette sequences. And what's, you know, common factor there between this and Pusher is that those sequences are just really well done, you know.
Yeah.
Both in The Deer Hunter and in Pusher, very hard-hitting sequences, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Big time. They start, I mean, the Deer Hunter Russian roulette scene is like one of those classic cinematic sequences. You know, it's gone down in history. And, you know, I'd argue that in Pusher, I mean, I'll argue for Pusher any day, as you know, but I'd argue that that final, that climax of the episode is one of the best climaxes the show ever did. You know, one of the most powerful, you know, where it's just brilliant.
And it's phenomenally well acted, you know. And that was kind of a point I wanted to touch on is, again, it's kind of a personal thing here for me, which is that when I was getting into films...
You played Russian roulette with someone?
Not quite, but what I did do...
it's what we're about to do now, guys, live, on air.
If this is the last episode of the podcast, it's been swell. but no, I mean, of the actors I really got into, Robert De Niro was the one, really. Well, Robert De Niro and Humphrey Bogart were the ones that really interested me. And De Niro, I would just watch film after film, especially from that era, you know, the films he did with Scorsese, things like Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. You can't see Tony right now, but...
I'm about to do my Robert De Niro. I'm trying to jut my chin. Doesn't sound like him, does it? Sounds more like Marlon. I'm going for more of a Marlon Brando from The Godfather.
Well, as we know, De Niro played a young Brando in The Godfather 2.
Sorry. I'm trying to throw him off here by doing...
Do my De Niro. You got to do the jut out chin.
Well,
jut
I was into Pacino as well. Can you do him?
Hoo-ha! That's it. That is literally my Al Pacino impression.
Yeah, so anyway...
Sorry.
So no, The Deer Hunter was in that sort of sequence of films I was watching, and they were just really like made a big impression on me.
Yeah.
You know? So I think I must have seen Pusher first. You know, it's one of those things where I cycled back and worked out what the reference was.
Yeah. That's always fun as well, isn't it? It's fun like realizing that there is obviously some sort of connective, and that then you go and explore it because you haven't seen the film. I always like that. You know, it just adds a little bit of depth. You know, and In fact, I was going to say this at the start of the episode, shout out to Kimon Keremidis for eatthecorn.com, which is obviously a great resource, as we know. But there's a whole series of articles Kimon's done for each season up until season 9, where he's touched on a lot of these, for per episode, the cinematic touchstones. And it was hugely useful for us making this one. But it's got lots of... If you're not sure about some of these connectives, go and look at those articles, because then you'll go, oh, wow, that's... Bad Day at Black Rock, and then you can potentially find a window to explore in all these movies you may not have heard.
Yeah, it's a great site, and hopefully you'll update it for seasons 10 and 11, even though I know you're not the biggest fan of them. But
yeah, let's hope so. Do that if you're listening, Kim, do it. Yeah,
do.
That'd be great. Yeah.
But are you like me, that you will seek stuff out if you figure out there's a reference in an episode
or
something like that? Because that's always what I was kind of like, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm just constantly trying to find films I haven't seen, or things I've not really heard about, or you know, I'm kind of trying to pace watching all the classic movies as well. I'm not one of these people who's watched all the classics. You know, there are definitely things I haven't seen, and I'm doing that partly intentionally because I want to save things throughout my journey through cinema.
Well, it's hard though, because I just end up watching a lot of 90s TV that I've seen like a million times before.
Exactly, we just get sucked down this rabbit hole. Deer Hunter is one I need to revisit. It's a good one.
Yeah, it's one I don't rewatch too frequently because it's so powerful. I almost don't want to dilute it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to sort of get too familiar with it.
This is it. This is one of those. I'm a bit like that with Don't Look Now, actually.
Yeah.
You know, you want to go back and just remember the power of it and be swept up in it, definitely.
I'm shocked, Tony, that you didn't pick it, but I'm glad I did then.
No, it did cross my mind, but that's a good one. I tell you what we'll do. I'll do my second one. You do then your least favourite, and I'll finish with my favourite. Should we do that?
Yeah.
That's a nice little back and forth. So, my second one is probably the most... Well, no, actually, it probably isn't the most famous. It's probably on a par of the last two I've got. A film which is based on an episode in the sixth season, which I'm particularly a fan of, called Drive.
Oh, and I think it was called The Bus That Couldn't Slow Down.
Yes.
That's a Simpsons reference.
I've heard that one before, yeah. Or the sequel was called The Cruise Ship That Should Never Have Been Made a Film On.
Yes.
Speed, the 1994 Jan de Bont action thriller starring Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock and Dennis Hopper, which is all about a bus that has been rigged with a bomb, and if it goes under... I think, is it like 60 miles an hour or something like that? 60 kilometres an hour, something like that. It's going to blow up anyway. And there's a whole bus load of passengers, and Keanu Reeves has to keep the bus going until he can figure out how to defuse this bomb. It is the ultimate in high concept Hollywood action 90s thriller. And it's also one of the best 90s action thrillers, I think, that was ever made.
Yeah, I mean, I like Speed. I haven't seen it probably in like 10 years or so. Yeah. But and it's kind of genius the way they kind of appropriate it then for X-Files, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Really is.
And for Father Ted.
Is that a milk cart? <isn't it? laughs>
If anyone's unfamiliar with Father Ted, it's a brilliant Channel 4 Irish sitcom. Well, not even sitcom. Well, it's just a bonkers comedy about a bunch of priests. And there's an episode called Speed 3. I urge you to go and watch it, okay? Because it is a bomb and a milk float. It's one of the best, funniest things I've ever seen in my life. But yeah, Speed rippled through pop culture very fast, and it sort of stayed there. You know, you'll get all kinds of comedies, movies still reference Speed even now, 25 years on. And Drive was a great example of that, because Drive obviously is Bryan Cranston's, what was his name? Oh,
Patrick
Crump. That's it. Yeah, who because of the Navy radio waves that have been beaming into his head, his head's gonna blow unless he keeps driving west towards the coast. And then Mulder obviously gets in the car, and then it's just a real interesting... It's not even a thriller or a thrill ride in the same sense. It's more of a conspiratorial sort of action drama in a weird way. It's a sort of a Vince Gilligan blend of things with a lot of social commentary in it.
Because you also go back and forth, don't you, between Mulder and Scully. And Scully's got her own... She's kind of in her own, like, paranoid thriller, isn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Kind of juxtaposed with Mulder's kind of high-octane, hot-shot driving, so... Yeah, there's a lot going on in Drive. I think it is a great episode. I think also it's one of the... I mean, it's the second episode in LA, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the first great one, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And because it's sun-baked environments, you know. It's them making a lot of the use of the new kind of desert locations they've got access to with Drive. So it feels like a hotter... You know, I think the opening scene of Mulder and Scully is visiting this farmer in the... You know,
because they're off the X-Files, of course, at this point, aren't
they? Yeah. Looking for like domestic terrorism muck or fertilizer or something.
Yeah.
So there's stuff they wouldn't have done in Vancouver because they don't have the sweltering heat. So yeah, I think it's a great... It's not a direct... It's not like Ice in that it's a direct Speed ripoff or homage, but it's definitely one of those episodes that without Speed you wouldn't have got quite done in the same way, I think.
Maybe there's something else we can talk about here, which is like, I think like David Duchovny, I think, is one of the great TV stars of the 90s.
Yeah.
But he also gets quite a bit of criticism for his low-key acting style at times.
Yeah.
Keanu Reeves, probably you would say one of the action stars of the 90s with this. The Matrix at one end of the decade.
Yeah, yeah.
And like Point Break at the other end.
At the other end.
Also somebody who gets a bit of criticism for his acting.
Yeah.
You know. So also,
justified if you've seen Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh my god. That's like, he's English, isn't he, in that?
Yeah.
That's the worst.
Ooh, Mina Harker, I'm terribly sorry for all that Van Helsing. Oh yeah. It's just, oh my god. It's not even going there.
I've never seen Duchovny turn in a performance quite like
that.
Even in like, you know, the height of his kind of boredom with the X-Files.
Excelsis Day. He wasn't even as bad in that. But he was clearly trying to fight staying awake.
Yeah. And I mean, what I remember primarily about Speed is probably one of the first films I saw Dennis Hopper in, kind of a nice villainous turn there, isn't
he? Oh, he's wonderful in that. He's purely mental. I mean, Dennis Hopper was a bit crazy anyway in real life. You know, he was a fascinating character, had a hell of a life. But yeah, in Speed, he's like, he's a nut job. He's a true nut job, and he's brilliant. You know, like this on the phone. What are you gonna do, Jack? It's just that kind of just pure. He's like the Joker. You know, that he's it's just a gleefully manic bad guy turn.
And somebody rose to fame, of course, in a classic road movie of sorts with Easy Rider.
Easy Rider,
the tail end of the 60s.
Yeah, great film. Again, like quite oddball in its own way. Easy Rider, very much.
I mean, that's
late
a film.
60s drug hangover.
Jack Nicholson obviously appears in that film. Is he in one of your? Is he one of your impressions you wheel out or not?
I can. Have a go. You gotta get the movements with Jack. He's got a bob of the head, what he always does.
Carl's getting the full one here because
I can see Tony's shit-eating grin as he's
That's true. I can bust out impressions of all of them, buddy.
But yeah, I'll stop now. Although the next one, there's very likely going to be an impression, right? And I'm going off. Oh no, you need to do your least favourite first.
You
do your least favourite first and then I'll come back and do another bad impression.
May not necessarily come as a surprise to people who listen to our Podwatch series, because I've chosen a scene from Dreamland. It's the scene in which Fox Mulder, inhabiting the body of Morris Fletcher, is in his new domestic milieu, and he's in front of the mirror, isn't he? A bedroom mirror. And for no apparent reason, he opts to kind of dance in front of the mirror, accompanied by one of the most puzzling choices for music that Mark Snow's ever made on the series, I think. But in any case, I don't want to dwell on it too much. But I mean, what film am I thinking that's
from? Oh, God. I don't think I know. I really don't think I know. Go on.
That's right. Well, I think it's a scene from a film called Duck Soup from 1933, which is the Marx Brothers.
Oh, right. Yes.
Now, I think when I mentioned this on the Podwatch, I think somebody came back and said that they thought it was actually a rip-off of an I Love Lucy sequence.
Okay.
But I think the I Love Lucy one was with Harpo Marx. So I think that in itself was a Duck Soup.
Yeah. Reference.
I mean, have you seen any of the Marx Brothers, or is that?
I haven't. No. Again, that's stuff to do.
I think the difference here is that the Dreamland sequence, you know, there's a couple of differences actually. I think in Duck Soup, all the Marxes are physically present and they're trying to mirror each other's movements.
Whereas
in Dreamland, what we've got is Mulder. It's his reflection, isn't it? It's Michael McKean acting as his reflection.
Yeah.
But in universe, it's Mulder dancing, and his reflection just happens to look like Morris Fletcher.
Right.
Okay. So, in Duck Soup, what's weird is that the Marx Brothers are these, like, anarchic, kind of freewheeling figures.
Yeah.
And, you know, their films are kind of really crazy, and there's all sorts going on. But actually, the mirror sequence in Duck Soup is more justified in a plot sense than the Dreamland sequence is in Dreamland. And I don't know what you think about it, because I'm keen to get your take. I mean, I think I might be a man alone on this.
Oh, well, I think, it's like, you know, it's classic comedy subjectivity, isn't it? I mean, you know, what's funny for one person isn't necessarily funny for another. I've always laughed at it, but on a basic level, it's physical comedy for me. Yeah. It's why I'm sure I'll enjoy the Marx Brothers and all these kind of things, because physical comedy, anyone falling down in any film, almost any film, I'm like, or dancing like a goon, I will laugh, right? It's a basic thing. So I've always enjoyed it, but I can see why it would potentially grate. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, no, I understand that.
I'm sure you're not on your own. There will be other people.
Yeah, well, I'd like as much support as possible from listeners. I don't think there's going to be much forthcoming, but anyway.
So you've never done that in front of the mirror?
I never have, no, but who knows? There's a first time for everything, isn't there? I do get what you're saying, though, because I guess it would be like things like the dance in Babylon, for example.
Yeah.
Where, like, when Mulder does a backflip there, I do confess, it makes me laugh every time.
Now, you see, I suppose this is where we flip, because I think that whole thing is garbage. So, do you know what I mean? Again, it's the same thing.
But it just feels like, I think I said this on the Podwatch, but it just feels like the actors wanted a bit of a showcase in Dreamland. It doesn't really feel...
It's not. You don't need to do it, do you?
No, you don't.
They're just trying to be goofy.
In terms of the Marx Brothers, I mean, I do like them too. They made a series of films like for Paramount. Duck Soup, I think, is the last one. They just can do whatever they want. You know, the plots are really kind of incidental, you know. And then sadly, I think they go to MGM and their films, they try and put them in the box a bit more, you know, and they try and take away what was great about them. So Duck Soup, I would recommend. I think if you're only going to watch one Marx Brothers film, Duck Soup is the one.
Duck Soup.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's my.
I'll bear that in mind then. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Like I said, I don't have a least favourite because I'm woefully underprepared as normal. we'll finish with my favourite. Well, not my favourite actually. No, that's not true. With my last one.
Yeah.
One of my favourites, which is based on two episodes. And let's see if you can guess right the film. Okay, two episodes. Two very different episodes in two different places. Colony / Endgame and Essence / Existence.
Okay.
What film am I going to bust out here?
Well, if I'm right, and I might be wrong, I'm not sure, but if I'm right, we've moved from the 70s to the 80s.
We have.
Have we? I think we're talking getting warm. About an Austrian actor turned politician. Am I right? Am I warm?
We might be Carl.
I think we're talking about the Terminator.
You are correct.
It's either that or it's Kindergarten Cop. I'm not really sure.
No, it's the Terminator starring Arnie. Because let's be honest, the alien bounty hunter is the Terminator, isn't he? I mean, you know, he pretty much they've modelled that whole character and the way he appears. There is a very much a Terminator nod. And you know, everyone knows the story of the Terminator. I don't need to go through that. James Cameron's original and sequel from 84 and 91, I think, if I've got my dates right.
Okay. Yep.
Classic science fiction. And they have inspired so much. And I think with Essence and Existence, I think there's a strong argument that they inspired the super soldiers as well. You know, people like Noel Roar, the wonderfully named Noel Roar, and Agent Crane, and all these guys, Billy Miles.
Yeah.
You know, and Billy Miles is very Terminator in that. You know, where he's walking around lopping heads off, and you know, he's reconstructed metal exoskeleton and all this kind of thing. He's more like a machine than a human at that point. And that's the whole thing with the Terminator. He's a robot from the future programmed to kill us all. So that's a big one for me. That's a big inspiration I love. Because every time I watch these episodes, and Colony and Endgame are two of my favourites, like they are a lot of people. Especially Colony, in a way, he's very Terminator.
You know? It's very... I think it's one of those where I probably saw the episodes way before I saw the Terminator. But yeah, you can't get away from it, can you?
No.
But... I must confess, with the bounty hunter, that I think he's brilliant in Colony Endgame. I think that we maybe... I know we didn't see that much of him, but I think he was never quite as effective again, I would...
I'd agree with that, really. And I kind of think they knew that, in a way.
Maybe
which
that's
is
why we didn't see too much.
Yeah, I think they always realised they couldn't do a lot with him, because he was... I think they knew he was good and they wanted to bring him back, but... Again, it was like, well, how do you top Colin in Endgame? He was perfect in that role. You didn't need to see him again, I suppose. I know he turns up. I mean, I really like the end of Talitha Kumi. It gets a lot of stick, but I think that's a great cliffhanger. So it was really exciting that, but you didn't need it.
Yeah, I'm kind of half with you on Talitha Kumi, because I remember that was like the height of my X-Files obsession. And at the time, I was really kind of just kind of shocked by that cliffhanger. But it's kind of like, going back, I can't really see why, because... It's not as epic as something like Mother in a Boxcar or Mulder is Dead or whatever.
No, it's not.
Seasons. But
it's not.
I've just got that personal memory of like just kind of being at the edge of my seat. Like,
yeah,
you know.
It was a hellish like 3 month, 4 month wait for Terrorvolk. That was, because it's more of a simple, straightforward cliffhanger. You know, whereas things like Anasazi and even Gethsemane, stuff like that, are more, you know. They're slightly different in that sense.
Yeah, and then in terms of like the season 8 stuff, I think that's a point people differ on, don't they? I mean, the Billy Miles stuff and so on. I know, like, we were talking about Kimon. I remember speaking to him, I think, or seeing some of his tweets, and he's not really into that stuff as much. No. I thought, in terms of the story they were telling at that time, I thought it worked pretty well, honestly.
I think Existence is brilliant they're just terrifying machines, you know. That whole sequence in the FBI, I love all that. Where Doggett and Skinner in particular are getting, you know, chased. It's great. So
yeah, I think it's kind of retroactively tarnished a bit by the season 9 Super Soldier stuff is nowhere near as compelling as it, I suppose.
No. But I think up to season 8 to Super Soldier stuff is terrific, really. So that's my last one.
Well, let me get you on the record then. The Terminator. Are you a Terminator fan, or are you a Terminator 2 fan primarily?
You see, this is one of those, I think it's a really... unfair question in a way, because they're very different. They're very different films. They are... The first one is more of a stripped-back, sort of pulpy B-movie thriller, and the second one is much more of an apocalyptic, you know, doom-laden, you know, 90s blockbuster. So they're very different stylistically.
Yep.
If somebody put a Russian roulette gun to my head, I think I'd probably go with T2. But by a whisker, because I think they're both brilliant.
I think I would go the other way. I think I like the rough edges of the first one, which have kind of been smoothed away, haven't they, by the time T2 comes around.
But they have.
No, they're both excellent, aren't they?
Well, I'll get to judge this next week, because as of recording, I'm doing an Arnie marathon. Six Arnie films. Maybe, yeah. Actually, I think it's seven Arnie films. back to back, overnight, with two of my mates.
So, yeah.
Both of which include The Terminator.
Yeah. So,
Terminator 1, Terminator 2.
Terminator 1, Terminator 2, Twins, all the way.
Yeah, Kindergarten Cop, Junior.
Jeez. That sounds really fun.
Yeah,
have a great time.
It should be good. And what I'd love one day is an X-Files, like, all-nighter.
That'd be good. We need to organise it, don't we?
We should. Hire out a cinema screen somewhere. And put
the electric. You can hire at the electric, can't you?
You can. That's where we were today in Birmingham. That might be worth looking at. Yeah, for UK fans at least. Unless you want to get a plane, guys.
What would you screen? I'd screen, I think, My Struggle 4, but make it like an audience participation. like they do with a Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah. Or The Room.
Or The Room.
That's a good idea.
You know, so just imagine a cinema full of people screaming, you know, I've got some payback to pay back in unison. That'd be a beautiful thing.
Be amazing. Definitely. I think you'd have to get some Darren Morgans on as well. I think I'd have Ose Chung, I think, probably.
Yes, I think so.
You know, because you can have people going, you know, bleeping all over the place. And then when you get the moment. Get a whole super doing that.
Yeah. What would you have? I don't know. I think something like Drive would work well in that setting.
Yeah,
it would.
Yeah.
Because that's very cinematic.
Yeah.
You know?
There's a lot, actually. There's a lot you could put on. I mean, I'd be tempted to say The Unopened File. You know, the Anasazi trilogy, really. I think that would look great on a big screen.
Well, that would be a great 70s conspiracy thriller-esque story. Just to,
it would.
You know, take in that setting, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Maybe we should do this. Hire a cinema and program an X-Files marathon. Watch this space. Yeah. Anything's possible.
You never know.
But yeah, this has been fun talking about movies in the X-Files. And I'm surprised we only overlapped with one film.
I'm surprised. Actually. And I'm surprised that it was Don't Look Now. I would have put money on it being Pusher. So
yeah. Or The Thing, actually.
As Mulder said to Scully in Thief, Tony, you always keep me guessing.
That is a wonderfully obscure reference. But, well, is it? Probably not. It's probably a good ship moment.
I'm sure our listeners all know it.
But it's probably the only thing from Thief people remember, really.
Probably.
But yeah. So, no, thanks for listening, guys. If you've got your own movie combinations, movie, you know, inspirations for the X-Files or think links like we've come up with, let us know on the Basement Group or on Twitter. Get back to us. Because you never know, we might do a sequel.
You know, there's enough stuff out there isn't that we haven't even touched on. So
episode 2, you know, in Star Wars. Actually, no, more like episode 5.
Yes,
we don't want any prequels, do we? But yeah, there's loads. Yeah, we may well come back and revisit this topic. So shout out your own ideas, and you never know, we might talk a bit about them in a prospective sequel. So whether we'll do it live, I don't know. I'd like to think this won't be the last live together one we do, given we only live like about 10 miles distance from each other.
Yeah, well, let's hope the sound file comes out. We've had some technical issues.
We have.
It's been fun.
It has been fun, so hopefully it won't be the last one. Until next time, guys, as always, and this is broadcasting live, trust no one.
The X-Cast is produced and presented by Tony Black, part of the Black Hole Media podcast network. Title music is courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at IamWillAye.